From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 104 with guest Kim Tripp, recorded Thursday, March 12th, 2009. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
You're listening to Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host and newly minted pilot friend, Greg Hughes.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
Well, congratulations, man.
Thanks. Yeah, I finished my private pilot's certificate.
You get your VFR license, Greg?
Yeah, I can fly you around in the air now.
Right on. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's actually a lot of fun. I started the private pilot training down here. I live in Portland, Oregon area, and down here in Hillsboro in mid-September, and actually finished it last week, so early March. First week of March is when I finished it all.
Wow.
Can I ask what you did for your long-distance solo flight, your first long-distance solo flight?
So, sure. My first solo, I flew down to Lebanon, Oregon, which nobody, I'm sure, has ever heard of, and back. And then my long-distance solo flight, I flew from Hillsboro down to Newport, Oregon, which is southwest of here on the coast. And then from there, flew up the coast, which on a beautiful day, it was literally 70 degrees up in the air in January. And flew all the way up to Astoria, which is at the mouth of the Columbia River right there, right at the top northwest corner of Oregon, and then from there back to the Portland area. So it was a lot of fun.
Hillsboro was one of my stops on my long-distance solo flight. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I know it well.
And for our listeners that haven't guessed yet, our guest today is none other than Kim Tripp. Needs no introduction. Friend of the show. My dear, dear friend. And of course, immediately we're just in conversation because we never get a chance to talk to each other near enough.
So yeah. I know, it's pathetic.
Well, it's good to talk to you again, Kim.
I've actually got my logbook out. I'm actually finding when I flew to Hoquiam and, it was Hoquiam, I was thinking.
That's funny.
No,
that's
sorry,
cool.
I'll shut this, but yeah. Anyway, you guys catch up. I'll be quiet for another minute or two. I'm sorry.
Let's do the show.
Next time we get together, we'll have to geek out on pilot stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I just don't, you know what, I'm not current. I haven't flown. Nobody would give me a plane at all, but it's such a great hobby. I mean, it's just so fascinating to learn all the radio speak and everything you need to do to learn where you can fly, where you can't fly, different altitudes,
sure.
What happens when you have to fly around SeaTac. I mean, I've got some great stories, but I haven't piloted a plane since 95, so
it's
been many, many moons.
Next time you're in the Portland area, then make sure you let me know and we'll fly
totally.
For a while.
I would love to go. What are you flying then? Cessna 172s?
Well, I learned in a 150.
Yeah, okay.
And now it's a Warrior, so 150
horsepower. Ah, Piper Cherokee Warrior. Those are great planes, low-wing planes. I flew those, too. I was flying those and 172s.
Yeah, so a whole lot of fun. Definitely the Freedom is pretty darn cool.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. Oh, we could do a whole show. There's actually probably a whole bunch of other geeky people that are all certified and love to fly as well.
Yeah, that would be interesting. But in the meanwhile...
Sorry.
So, Kim, the reason we're doing this show, actually, is a bunch of emails you and I were involved in around this whole state of affairs with developers and DBAs these days. And you seemed a little surprised. Why don't you tell me your version of the story here?
Well, okay. So Timmy Huckabee sent an email because he was going to do an interview for a San Diego newspaper or magazine. And just wanted to kind of chat a little bit about features that developers would really be excited about in SQL 2008.
Right.
At least that's what I took the email to be about. So we kind of started down the path of talking about new developer features, and I forget how it kind of went off tangent, but it kind of got into the, well, but does a developer really need to know all of these features? And does a developer really have to know SQL really well to leverage SQL as a back end. And that kind of spiraled into a, well, wait a minute, whose job is it to do the database schema, the database tables, the indexes, the stored procedures? Is it the database administrator that has to write the code to slam that code into production? Because obviously a DBA is the only one that should really be implementing the code. But is it really the DBA that writes the code? Or is it a specific person, a database developer,
right,
that is, you know, knowledgeable about SQL that creates all this? Or is it the app developer? And so that kind of spiraled into a huge discussion that must have had probably 20 emails back and forth. And I ended up writing a blog post titled, Whose Job Is It Anyway? And kind of went into, do you think that there's three distinct roles here? Do you think there's an app dev, a database developer, and a DBA, or not? And it was great. I got great comments to it. You know, not only was our thread fantastic, but I really learned a lot about how people are viewing kind of the world of SQL. And that's actually spiraled into a whole bunch of other blog posts.
But isn't, I mean, not just SQL per se, but this whole point of data storage in general is becoming more and more amorphous, I think, to developers, where they're just saying, it's just plumbing. I just say, store this, and it happens. I don't need to think past that.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments from folks that said, and they didn't believe this, actually. They commented that they're hearing a lot that SQL is kind of set it and forget it technology.
Right.
You know, you can slam the objects in there, and SQL will just do its thing. From the last run as, when we talked about indexes, I had a database developer who sent me an email. Sorry, I had an involuntary DBA send me an email that said, you know what, I don't know much about indexes, but I decided to listen to your run as, and I found that my databases don't have any indexes. Their developers had told him, you know, as this kind of part-time DBA that really wasn't even meant to learn SQL, they had told him, oh, SQL just does all that for me. I don't need to know about the indexes. I don't need to know any of that stuff. SQL just does it. And I think with the SQL is plumbing and set it and forget it technology and the SQL just does it for me kind of mentality that's happening, we're seeing even bigger problems as databases try unsuccessfully to scale.
And of course, this only ever hits after the app is shipped and gets busy, and suddenly there are problems. And it's funny how often developers just talk about the problem of SQL Server, how it's the source of all pain.
Oh, I totally agree.
And at the same time saying, set it and forget it. Like, what'd you think was going to happen?
Well, and that's, you know, so I talk about database best practices, design best practices, indexes, but one thing that we've started to get even more involved in is telling people how important certain maintenance tasks are and when to do those maintenance tasks. In fact, I probably shouldn't even embarrass myself and say this, but I had this long blog post typed up yesterday, and I do have autosave on, but I accidentally reached for my mouse and hit the back button, and I lost like an hour of my last post, even though it had autosaved. When I hit back, it overwrote the autosave.
I've never done that before.
Oh man, I was so. Jeez. You should ask Paul. Like he's like, Kimberly is so nice when she presents, but when something happens and she's really irritated, you should hear the things that come out of her.
Yeah,
it was a very colorful moment or two in the house when I realized that I had lost like at least. Even with autosave, I would have had everything, but it must have been an hour or two. So I've now started to rewrite that post, and I've turned it into three, and it's going to be about database maintenance. But I guess my point is I'm seeing a lot more of this SQL is just plumbing. We create it, and it goes out there. And then when people have problems, it's all about, oh, well, SQL doesn't do this, and SQL doesn't do that, and it's not set it and forget it technology. I mean, there's some things that SQL does really well for you. But if you don't go and do kind of root cause analysis for why you've gotten into some of the situations, some of these quick fixes that I've seen as posts to, let's say, huge transaction logs, you know, they're not solving the problem. They're quick fixing, do this, And it's, how do I want to phrase this? It's a developer just saying, okay, that fixes my problem. Let me go on and put out some other fire, you know? And they're never really stepping back and saying, why did I have this problem? And
right.
What was it in SQL that I did wrong potentially that I could have avoided this altogether? I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing like, I'm having this problem. Here's a quick fix. Move on. I'm seeing this problem. Quick fix. Move on. And it's really becoming, I think, problematic. People aren't putting enough effort into having a database focused person. They have DBAs, and the DBAs might, well, not every company has a full-time DBA, but the DBAs focus more on backup restore and disaster recovery and security. But I don't even know if all full-time DBAs are learning as much as they need to know about maintenance. Maybe they're thinking it's somebody else's job. I don't know. Richard, Greg, what do you guys think?
You know, the question that pops into my mind is, where is the architect in this whole thing?
Well, you know, an architect is another good question. Is that another role? Is there an architect that oversees the whole project? I would expect on bigger projects, yes. But
right.
Again, I'm seeing an app developer that just thinks about SQL as a storage area and doesn't
right.
think really that it matters how they define that storage area. SQL Server is just going to deal with it. And then maybe there's some operational person that, again, maybe doesn't know SQL all that well, and they're now having scalability problems because they've defined some app that's not really fully taking advantage of SQL
mm-hmm.
Server, or they've done things in the application that really aren't ideal in SQL Server, but nobody's told them otherwise.
Well, you know, and as a non-developer IT management guy who had a real recent guest who, and Richard, you might tell me if my paraphrase is accurate here, who said something along the lines of, you know, the difference between programming and using SQL Server is, you know, when you're a programmer, you're telling the machine what to do, whereas when you are interacting with SQL Server, you know, you're telling it how to characterize or what information you want.
Yeah, what your sort of desired outcome is.
Right.
Yeah,
you know, what, you're asking it for output as opposed to telling it what to do. But Kim, so I'm sort of translating what you're saying and trying to sort of match these things together. If you treat it just as a set it and forget it or a black box, kind of throw something at it and have it come back, and you simply assume that what it does, it's going to do really well and do it in the most optimum way, that may or may not be the case.
Yeah, okay, so SQL Server has an incredibly intelligent optimizer, don't get me wrong, but there are things that when you write T-SQL, if you don't write them optimally, there are things that they just won't do a good job with ever. Like one
oh,
of my
sure.
favorite really simple examples is isolating a column to one side of an expression. Like if you have a monthly salary column, and somebody writes a query that says, select star from employees where monthly salary times 12 is greater than some value.
Uh-huh.
The way that that works, and you might even argue that the SQL team could have rewritten this, but the way that that works is they look at that expression and they're going to evaluate monthly salary times 12 for every salary of the table. So it's going to force a scan. It's not going
gotcha.
To... move the times 12 to the other side. And I know that's pure algebra. And yes, the SQL team, they're well beyond knowing basic algebra. But you have to think of an optimizer as, and this is a great, great line to say, but it has to come up with a good plan fast. And what that means is that it has to be efficient. It has to be well written and it has to be tight. You know, it has to, not have a lot of extraneous code. And my reason to say that is if they were to put in all sorts of, you know, where clause rewrites, and especially simple rewrites, you could end up bloating the optimizer with a whole bunch of stuff that normally it wouldn't have to use, and you'd start making the process of optimization inoptimal in and of itself. And
mm-hmm.
you could make the argument that I guess they could put in all sorts of rewriting and make optimization more expensive so so that you could kind of almost write any SQL command, and they figure out what you kind of wanted to do. But it kind of defeats the purpose of a truly scalable environment. I think they'd be going the wrong direction doing that. You know, they just make the optimizer so expensive. So I guess my point is, if a developer that knows SQL knows to avoid these things, they can write right. better, more efficient, more scalable SQL that can really leverage all the things that an optimizer can do that is much more complex than that. Do you kind of see where I'm going with that?
You know, and I immediately hit on this idea of, is this how cloud computing with data storage has really come into play? I don't want to know. I don't want to think about it. I just want to store my data and get it back, and it'll always be fast. And the promise of cloud computing is it'll always scale. I just don't, you know, don't need to know anything.
Or is that the myth of cloud computing?
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, see, I don't know enough to speak intelligently about how cloud is being written and so forth, but it is a whole nother interesting scenario of kind of set it and forget it.
Absolutely.
And it's mm-hmm. even, I'd say, even more beyond that, in that it's a, I don't even want to manage it, you know? It's
right.
not just set it and forget it. It's set it, forget it, and not even management, and somebody else is going to back it up, somebody else is going to restore it.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, it might actually be a more experienced DBA that is managing your databases in the cloud. There's no doubt about that. But I still think there's going to be certain things, and this is something that I have chatted with a few folks about cloud. You know, what is it that a DBA managing their data in the cloud is going to be allowed to do, and or what do they need to do versus what the operators that are running the cloud need to do? And this is
yeah.
a really big debate. I mean, this is a huge topic. What about performance tuning? Like, if I manage a SQL server, even though I don't know the databases, there are certain things that I, as an administrator, can start to see in terms of, you know, frequently executed queries that are exhausting a lot of resources, and I can start to even run those through tools like DTA, or use the DMVs, like there's missing index DMVs, and I could start using those tools without knowing the database app itself, just looking at the different activities that are going on, and I could start to add indexes, and I could start to, you know, do even more efficient kind of maintenance. But at the same time, and I have to argue both sides, there's things that the developer could have done better earlier on to have made some things even more scalable that there's no way that a DBA could do later to make things more efficient. Like,
true.
My favorite, the canonical example here is primary keys that are GUIDs that are then your clustering key.
Right.
And I had this discussion last time too, but I'm seeing this everywhere. Like, every application that I'm kind of running into that's being developed by database developers that, let's say, aren't, you know, really, really deep in SQL, they create these clustering keys as GUIDs, and the problem is it works fine when there's, you know, thousands of rows, even tens of thousands of rows, but as
right.
you get to millions of rows,
millions and, yeah.
as you get to an app that's in production, there's nothing a DBA can do except maintenance, and even then, it's a temporary fix to the problem. And the problem is way worse than just the fragmentation that's created. It's
yeah.
all of the keys that are unnecessarily wide, all of the tables that are wasting tremendous amounts of space by having these really much wider than necessary keys.
So, I mean, that really goes, that's the reason I asked the question, where's the architect in this picture? So much can be saved and done through some basic requirements and planning and having the right people involved at the very beginning.
So this is interesting. I think you and I might be saying, you're saying architect, I'm saying database developer. I'm not sure that every project has all four people.
And it doesn't have to be, but somebody who's filling the architecture role, in other words, the planning role, you know, in the design phase, you know, how do we ensure that we're looking at these critical you know, decisions and making these decisions in a smart way that takes into consideration, you know, so it's the strategic view of, you know, what it is that's being built, not just the tactical view. But you're right, it could be one person could be doing a couple of those roles.
Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting point here, I think, that and why you're saying the architect, is that ultimately the architect's responsibility is to make sure he does bring all of the players together.
See, that's, yeah.
And right, get those, right, that information. So, I mean, the reality is if a developer goes off and says, oh, I want to use GUIDs, if the database guy has no idea until the app is deployed, you know, then you get into that problem where if in the design meeting they said, well, we're going to use GUIDs, and the database guy goes, well, you know, there's some serious consequences to that.
Right.
See, and I'm expecting the database developer to be that guy to tell the architect who basically says, I want to use SQL, because I'm thinking that a lot of architects won't know this level of depth. They might, especially if they've started to see some of these problems in prior architectures, and they certainly can move that forward. But it to me is the database developer, and again, some people don't have this distinct person, so maybe it is the app dev that is the database developer, or is it the DBA that is the database developer, or is it the architect that is the database developer? What I'm finding, though, and I think this is the ultimate base of this discussion, is I'm finding that nobody thinks there needs to be a database developer, that nobody thinks that the architecture in SQL has to be thought out. Like, it just doesn't matter. And that's what's maybe freaking me out. You know, it's like, it's surprising me, I guess, is that that's the whole thing here, is I'm really surprised at how people are thinking that you just don't need to put the effort into the database schema. And I'm not sure whose job it is to call this out and whose job it is to know early on, because I don't think every project has all of these distinct people unless you're at the very high-end enterprise. But at the low end, I'm just seeing more of a who cares, you know, it doesn't need to be done kind of attitude. And it's getting people into a lot of trouble in terms of scalability of their application.
And you don't need necessarily to have all those people as individual people, but each of those roles...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, are critical to doing things well, I think. So, I mean, Kim, my perspective is from, I have the perspective of building enterprise software and leading teams that are building, you know, millions of end users based on SQL enterprise applications in financial services, right? And so I guess the way, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about this, I think about this in terms of product development. And I know that in an IT organization for internal development, a lot of times it's thought of as, well, we'll just sort of put this together and make it work, and then we'll sort of tweak it as time goes on. You don't get that luxury, or maybe it's not a luxury. Maybe that's actually a mistake to try to think that way. Maybe people should be thinking in terms of product development, which is, I'm going to build something. I'm going to test it. It's going to be well thought out and well architected ahead of time, because I'm going to hand this off to somebody and they have to be able to rely on it.
Well, and that's something that I always try to get people to do, is spend more time in design and pseudocode or prototyping, you know, certain design techniques, because not every design technique works for every, you know, implementation. The different usage patterns warrant, in some cases, different design strategies. Mm-hmm. And as a result of not thinking about it, you know, putting it together, as you say, and just making it work, you put all this code, all these stored procedures, views, functions, triggers, on top of a schema that hasn't been well thought out, and the problem that you have is you can't change it now, because as soon as you change the schema, all that code you've written, all those stored procedures, triggers, views, functions, will probably need to be rewritten.
Right.
And your ultimate problem is, now you're in a, well, we just need to make it work, and we just need to make it better than it is now, when it won't really ever fully scale, because there's some things that have been done so poorly, so early, and they were so fundamentally wrong, that there's just almost nothing you can do except re-architect.
If you're going to build a house, you have to have that strong foundation, and it has to be properly designed and tested, and everything has to be good about it before you start building the sticks on top of that to build the walls, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise, it will all fall down. There's a really bad analogy, but you know, probably a cliche analogy. Richard, actually, you know a lot about that, don't you?
Thanks for that.
What, cliche analogy?
Foundations and building new houses on top of them.
Building new houses, yes. So Kim and I are competing for the longest renovation in history.
Hey, man, we're taking a year off.
I'm almost 2 months. I'm maybe 2 months away from finishing, but that's a whole other story. You know, getting back to Huckabee's email, one of the things he said that I think really made you jump was this idea that the DBAs, that the guys who own the database, are an obstacle to building applications, that the developers are just going around them any way they can.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that developers are either having to fight with DBAs or having to ask this, I think, was also another issue right along that same line. Having to go to a DBA to ask them to write a stored procedure so that they'll put it into place, because they're the ones that know everything about how SQL works. And in my experience, I really think of the DBA as the person that does security, backup restore, maintenance, disaster recovery, high availability. I don't think of the DBA as the ones that are creating the schemas, that are writing all that T-SQL. Now, a good DBA, I think, should know some T-SQL because they'll need it in scripting and in automation. But I wouldn't necessarily say that a DBA could write, you know, some 18-table join, because they wouldn't necessarily know the schema even well enough to do that.
Well, and you wouldn't necessarily want them to do that from a separation of duties standpoint.
Well, yeah, see, that was my thing, is I don't really want them. They've got enough to do with backup restore, disaster recovery.
Well, and you hand them all the keys to the kingdom, it creates some risk, some security risk as well.
But I do think there needs to be somebody, you know, there needs to be the role that is the bridge between the ownership operations of the database and what the developers need to get the database to do. Whether happens to also be the DBA or a separate person, or it's even a developer. You know, I don't know which seat that person sits in, but I think that too many organizations don't know who that person is.
Exactly. That's really fundamentally the question, is who is that person, and who are they putting the training and the effort into for somebody to actually know this stuff? Because if they don't, ultimately they're going to have bigger problems later, you know, in terms of the application scaling.
Well, I think the other side of this is that the workarounds that the developers are doing, and the other topic we haven't even touched on yet, I mentioned cloud, but the other one is the whole ORM system.
Yeah.
These tools that essentially, they build their objects and say, persist that to the database, and it will build whatever it needs to on the back end, and certainly with no thought to schema per se. Developers are being productive with that, because when they get into this obstacle scenario, they get in this situation where essentially I can't get my work done. I go and use this tool and it spits out the database stuff, goo that I need. So now I can get my work done. And when we're finished building the app, that's when we'll engage the database guys and go, oh yeah, and here's your database to take care of.
Yeah.
You know, the one with no primary keys. Yeah, that one.
Well, you know, speaking of no primary keys, I don't know really much at all about the entity framework. But one of the things that I found in kind of trolling around about whose job it was, and part of what started me on this whole rant, if you want to call it that, was that somebody had mentioned, and I'm embarrassed I don't remember who this is, I have to find this on my blog, but somebody had mentioned that the entity framework, when it creates a primary key, the default choice is to actually create the primary key over all of the not nullable columns of the table.
Awesome.
To just grab all of the not nullable columns and make them, as a unit, the primary key, which I don't know if it also then makes it what is the default, the clustering key. But if it does, just that step, if there's any non-clustered indexes, will cause the entire table to get rebuilt and all of the non-clustered indexes to get rebuilt, and it will create probably one of the worst keys that you could ever have for a table, let alone the primary key. And it's just, it's the absolute worst default I have ever heard. I mean, I created a blog post that was called, Seriously, Are You Kidding Me?
And this from a product that is owned by the SQL Server team.
Yeah.
I don't know who owns the specifically the entity framework, but it's definitely an interesting discussion in and of itself.
Right.
Well, someone should fix that.
Well, David Yak, who's another RD,
yes,
he posted on the blog, and I apologize. I think the gentleman's name is Ben. Oh, Paul came in and wrote a post-it note that is totally incorrect. I'm not even going to tell you what it said. I thought he was helping me, giving me the name, but no, of course not. But David Yak had posted on this gentleman's blog and said that you can deselect that default, making it the primary key, which is good. And I said, yes, that's great. But how many people are really going to know how bad this really is? You know what I mean? If you're using this to circumvent having to know the database, then you would almost expect, almost being the key word here, that whatever this product is that's leveraging SQL would help you, not completely shoot you in the foot, hurt you. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Absolutely. I think it's exactly the battle we're up against. So there's a lot of misunderstanding here, and we still have to surface all of it.
Well, I think there's misunderstanding in lots of products, and I'm starting to blog. I'm blogging a lot more this year, if anybody's noticed. Thank you. and I'm starting to put a lot more of kind of things I'm finding and issues I'm running into and why these things are bad, you know, kind of pros and cons. So stay tuned with that. I'm actually going to post a couple today on the blog post that I lost yesterday on
cool
issues I had found when I was surfing and recommendations that are really just not great recommendations.
All right, Kim, I think we're just about out of time. Any other
final words?
Oh, no. We could just
time
keep going.
Time flies,
now.
Huh?
This is another discussion I think we should have. I think this is a huge one, and maybe we could even just have a discussion sometime about just top 10 things a database developer shouldn't do. And
absolutely.
You know, just
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Things that we keep finding as issues. And these are things I'm blogging about as well, but it could warrant a whole show.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we've got some developer topics here to drag over to .NET Rocks as well.
Definitely.
Great.
Kim, thanks so much for coming on the show again.
Yeah, thanks you guys.
Thanks, Kim.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.